Welcome to The Bear and the Bull. I'm your host, Nick Webster. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Cassie Gray, who is the founder of Female Footballers, a non-profit helping young female identifying and non-binary players focus on the mental aspects of sports. Cassie, welcome to The Bear and the Bull.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat today.
So I hear that, you know, you have a quite a footballing background. Your husband's a former MLS player. Tell us more.
Yeah. So, well, I grew up playing soccer in the Bay Area, which is where I reside now, and was lucky enough to go through the ODP system, made my way up to the U18 national team, and got to play at UC Berkeley for 4 years in Division I. I was the generation where the NWSL didn't exist yet. The WSA was in existence, but the year that I graduated, the league folded. So there was another 6 years until pro soccer came around for women. So I played semi-pro for a few years. And around that time, my husband had just gotten drafted into MLS, and he was drafted to the Chicago Fire and then got traded to the San Jose Earthquakes around the time I graduated. So I kind of made the choice to move in with him and kind of follow his career for a few years. So I lived in Houston when he played for the Dynamo and he won the MLS Cup. And then we got he got traded to the LA Galaxy the same week that David Beckham got started with the Galaxy. So that was a bit of a circus, but we were there for that. And then he played for the Colorado Rapids and then ended his career back here in San Jose when the team came back. And so he retired here and now we're here. And I started Female Footballers a couple of years after that when we started having kids.
There's nothing like being married to a footballer and that traveling circus. I mean, how hard was that to move from city to city and you know, reestablish yourself each time, but at the same time, knowing that your husband's doing what he loves to do?
It's hard, you know, especially coming out of college soccer where soccer was about me and my life for so long, and then having to like transfer all of that into somebody else and figuring out at 22, like, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? I don't have the same opportunities. I was more than happy to support him in what he was doing, but it is very different from what people think it is, or maybe how it even is now. You know, MLS players back then, there were no guaranteed contracts. So financially, they're not like basketball, baseball, football players where it's just millions and millions of dollars, right? And then when you get traded in MLS, and I think to this day it's fairly similar, you're gone. You meet and go to the next team, and whoever you're with, you know, spouse-wise, or at the time we weren't even married, I was left to kind of move the whole house and pack everything up. And then you move to this new city and they have instant friends, instant job, instant, you know, a place for themselves. And you're kind of left having to create that all over again for yourself. So it was very difficult for a little while. I mean, again, we got very lucky. The Houston Dynamo, when he played for them, some of the gentlemen he played with and their wives were amazing. And that community was awesome. Actually, a tribute to that's how they won MLS Cup that year was 2006. They were just good people. And then, you know, LA was very different, especially during the Beckham era. You know, that was a circus, like I said. So just, you know, each team is such different cultures and learning that was unique, to say the least, especially in my mid-20s when most of the other girls my age were either trying to still make it in pro leagues in other countries or kind of just living up their 20s in big cities kind of.
What's it like when your husband or your other half comes home after a terrible game? I mean, how do you, is this where you started working on the mental aspects of soccer, do you think?
I think it was helpful. We both have a psychology background. I think it's helpful when he could come home and we could talk about things and I understood it. You know, I don't know what that's like to have a partner where they don't know what you do. So I found it helpful. I think he found it helpful that I could, you know, bypass all of the kind of like having to explain yourself in a certain way because I just understood what it was going to be like after a game. I knew how I felt. I knew him well enough to know what, you know, when they lost or when he had a bad game, what that might feel like. But it's still difficult, you know, and you have to provide something outside of that. Which is also hard when you're new to a city, like, well, how do I get past this mindset and put you in a place that makes you feel happier when also some of these guys are like their career is their whole life and it's their identity. And I think that can be really hard. So that was sort of an eye-opener for me at that time was learning that, you know, I was learning that my identity wasn't just a soccer player and that I had to have more. And I think it's even harder the higher up you go in the sport. When you're a pro athlete, that's a big piece that is difficult, I think, to separate yourself from.
So in that time of MLS, it really the league had just come out of contraction and the women's league had folded. Did you look at the two leagues and think about how the women maybe could have done it slightly differently? The women's league could have been slightly different, seeing that the MLS managed to get through that challenging period?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think at the time they invested so much money in the WSA and they didn't spend their money well in a way. And it, obviously there was a lot to that. But I also think the support around women's soccer was different. You know, I think people weren't sure that 99 was just a one-off thing. I think the 99er women worked really hard to start the conversation that is still going right now in women's soccer. And it was unfortunate they couldn't capitalize and have a more longer version of the WSA, but it was a start. And if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have the NWSL today. I always wondered why at the time, I remember feeling like, why didn't we just partner with the men's clubs and have, you know, the San Jose Earthquakes women and men at the time. But I don't think the world around men's soccer at that time wouldn't have wanted to do that. I think there's even struggles today. I know, you know, there's very few clubs that I think have awesome relationships. I think there's some for sure, but I know there's some where they're competitive with each other too, you know?
Why do you think that there isn't that support within the structure? I mean, I look at maybe Portland, I think is a great example of something that's worked quite well with the Thorns and the Timbers. But as we see that, you know, MLS is ever expanding, what is it, 31, 32 teams now, it does seem to me that you know, shared resources seems like a no-brainer. And with the explosion of the sport, and let's be honest, I mean, the sport is growing, certainly financially, and obviously in numbers. Why do you think there's that push and tug?
I think that people didn't feel like we should invest in the women's side of the game because they just never thought it was viable. And I think we've proven that in the last few years that that's not true. We were just never really given a chance. I think people looked at the WSA and thought that was your chance, but I don't think it had the type of money behind it that MLS ever did. And I think, you know, we proved in 99 that when people want to watch women's soccer, I mean, the Rose Bowl final where Brandi Chastain ripped her shirt off, that was like, you know, the quintessential, the amount of people that show up for those games. And I think it's been really exciting as a female soccer player and a mom of a daughter and another and boys who play soccer to see that we're finally transcending the gender around our sport a little bit. You see little boys carrying, and I think we're seeing it in other sports too. So, you know, when the WSA folded, at the same time, the WNBA was really starting to take off. And the more other sports can have some of that, the money backing. And I think the way that the WNBA did it is pretty smart. And, you know, but I would say, you know, college basketball is a perfect example with Caitlin Clark right now. Like, when you invest and you put time in and you have billboards and you have commercials and you have representation for women, the sport's going to grow. We didn't have enough of that in the early 2000s. And the men did, you know, the Beckham era, just living through that, you know, he was on everything. He was in every commercial. Like, living in LA, you couldn't escape Beckham. And so it wasn't just on a local level. It was obviously he's a global star. So that's a little bit different. But I think we're seeing in NWSL and the U.S. Women's National Team, like with Megan Rapinoe, when you give time and effort and money to a player, even, it's going to grow the sport. So
have you been following the Women's Gold Cup?
Yeah, it was so exciting.
So I was at the U.S.-Mexico game, and Mexico were unbelievable. And as I'm watching the game, I'm looking at there's two definitely distinct teams there. Not only the fact that, you know, obviously they're playing in different shirts, but just the, you know, the physicality, the makeup, the diversity of the teams. And I'm wondering, I'm looking at world football on the women's side of things, and you know, even going back to last year's World Cup, everybody's catching up to the US. The US was so far ahead of everybody for 2-3 decades, and now everybody's catching up. Why do you think that is?
I think that the style that we're playing right now, if I'm going to be really a little controversial, is kind of boring. I think that we are really valuing athletic players, which we do need to value, but we have a lot of them, and we've lost sight of some of the creative play, like a Tobin Heath type of player, where we have crafty technical players who can really make something creative happen on the field. I think we're missing that. And I think other countries, their style of play might be that way a little bit more. And we're putting a little bit too much into that physical, you know, bigger, stronger, faster, which it ends up playing a very direct, obvious style of play that I just don't feel like is dynamic. And so I think we've lost some of that. And they are catching up because other countries are also investing, you know, maybe not the same rate we are at the same level, but they are investing. And I think we're seeing that. So we have to really start to dive back into, you know, US soccer and coaching styles and playing styles and what we value. And I mean, I have a lot of opinions on that, but I'll leave it there for right now.
No, I couldn't agree more, because as I was watching the game, I'm really glad that you said that, because yeah, well, sometimes I'm not glad because we could like go back and forth against each other. But no, I'm in complete agreement, because as I'm watching the US players, I'm going, there's 11 players and every single one of them is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. They're all big, they're strong, they're athletic. But to your point, I'm saying to myself, where's the creativity? And I'm looking at the Mexican team, and you know, there's tall athletic girls, but there's small little girls, and just the way they played, it was just so exciting and so refreshing to see. And then, you know, my mind went back to the World Cup and watching Spain play and watching Colombia play, and some of these women are just out of their minds, brilliant in terms of technical skills. And so I'm talking to a colleague, and he's asking me, well, why do you think this is? And I'm convinced that it, you know, it begins at the youth level, and this obsession with winning, okay? And we're prioritizing these athletic young ladies because at 13, 14, 15, they can win games just on their, you know, athleticism, as opposed to their technical skills. And so we get to the point where, you know, they're now going to college, and I'm, you know, not a big fan of the college game. I don't think it helps build professional players. But how can we change that mentality? And I know this, you know, this starts going into your sphere of influence, female footballers. How do we tell young girls that it's okay not to win? It's okay to try and become a better player through your technical ability as opposed to your athletic ability.
Well, I think you have to have all of it. But I think what I get really frustrated with is, you know, youth sports and youth soccer in particular has become a multi-billion dollar industry. And until we at the top decide to invest, as much as we're investing in the women's game, and I'm all for it, we need to invest in our youth players. And I think that's what we're seeing. We get to the national team or the NWSL and we're like, this is boring soccer. But then nobody wants to put the time and money and resources into the youth game. And what I mean by that is coach education, it really does need to be about finding coaches that value whole player development and not just that winning mentality. It has to be around educating parents on what matters. But ultimately, our coaching style at the youth game is we are results driven. And when you're results driven, that tells kids that winning matters more than anything else. And so I believe in like a bottom to top approach rather than a top down. I think bottom up, you start at the youngest ages and you teach and you let kids fail and have creativity and learn from their mistakes. And we put value on, you know, improvement and self-improvement and comparing against your own self and not each other and less on winning. And then you grow that from the bottom up. And when I say whole player development, I mean all four pillars. You know, I think right now going to the United Soccer Coaches Convention, for example, in January, it's very cool to see a lot of like-minded people who care to give back to the game. They love this game. They want to do well amongst youth. But the amount of time and effort I see being put into data. Data is results, right? Like, it's great that we are tracking all the data and it's important, but we're heavy on data right now. And the elements in a game that we're frustrated with at the highest level is creativity. And that's not something we can always have data on. That's the element of the game that's like the, you know, the part that is what makes it most exciting, and we can't track. So giving time and space for that, and for me, the mental side is a big piece of that. So when I talk about female footballers and we talk about mental skills, I'm not a sports psychologist. I'm not pretending to be a sports psychologist. I think that sports psychologists are wonderful. They are more for a clinical crisis mode situation when a player is having, you know, is suffering or having those crisis moments. We go in and we're helping players navigate how it feels through that failure, because their coach is pulling them every time they make a mistake and they're not getting a chance to really show what they know and fail and be creative. We're helping them around, how did it feel to do that? And how do we overcome those challenges when we feel like, you know, our coach isn't supportive of that, or we're not making that team? And so a lot of the skills that we're talking about are social emotional learning skills that are being taught in classrooms by regular old teachers, and they need to be taught by coaches on a normal soccer field, but they're not getting taught because we're putting our priorities in other places. And I'm not, just to be clear, I'm not saying we don't want to put emphasis on data. Like, I do value that, but I do think we're a little bit not balanced in this way. And I think we need to put more time and effort into other areas that will promote eventually that creativity from the bottom up.
Wow, that's a lot to unpack there.
I know. Sorry.
No, that's great. So I definitely want to talk to you about that success failure thing and data points. Right. So here's a hypothesis. I'm a winger and I'm going to go up against my fullback. It's a 1v1. I lose it. So let's get into the mental side of things now. Now, as the winger, I'm like, why can't I beat this player? And as a data point, we're going failure. However, I think there's another way of looking at it where now all of a sudden the fullback's like, well, I own this player, but then they get beat that one time. And now all of a sudden, now these mental games start happening. But it's something that, you know, can you train that? Because it seems like it's an intrinsic value as opposed to an extrinsic value. So data, I feel, is extrinsic. Mental side, intrinsic.
I love that you're asking this question, because I think I get asked this a lot. And I think personally, all of our skills, our feelings, our emotions can be cultivated in our habits. So for example, let's take confidence. A player, yes, like having three children and seeing them born from nothing to who they are now. There are some of my children that I have are more naturally positive minded, right, than others. Like, I do think there's an element to, you know, how you view the world from a young age. However, I truly do believe that we can cultivate different feelings and character traits through practice and through making them a habit. So personally, I believe like confidence is a habit, not a trait, and we can cultivate it. And it really does take self-awareness and self-regulation skills. Those are the two things we focus highly on. So in my opinion, if a player that back that you're talking about who's going against and they make that one failure, if they're consistently practicing those moments where and allowed to practice being in the moment of failure, they're going to have the opportunity to practice different ways of handling that failure. And the more they can practice it, the more they can call on it in a moment when it actually happens in a game. No different than the repetition a technical skill takes. We have to repeatedly be given the opportunity to practice some of the areas that we can deem intrinsic or in what we might feel like is a weakness in ourselves, right? So when we're helping players kind of cultivate competence by learning different ways to practice it, a lot of it is reframing your brain, your self-talk, your internal monologues and how you speak to yourself. There's a lot of external factors that play a role. And I think we're in a time right now with players where if they don't have it, they quit. They're looked at as soft. They're, you know, that whole argument. And I think that we're trying to help players understand that, like, struggle is still a part of the game. You're going to fail. That is a part. Soccer is a game of mistakes, right? And you have a choice in that matter. Just like you have a choice to say, oh, I'm just not confident. That's a choice you're making. You're telling yourself that. If you switch and reframe your brain to think that I'm capable of this, I just need to put time and effort into it, I think it is, you know, it is something that you can cultivate. The same way that you can, you know, when you first pick up a ball and you're juggling, you're going to drop the ball a billion times. You have to keep putting the time and effort into that. So I do think that is a big piece of this that gets kind of mistaken and what coaches have a really hard time with. It's not a black and white concept. It's very gray. And as a society, we don't do great with gray. It's not tangible. So I think it's going to take a long time to get this idea as something that coaches really focus on.
The other thing that you hooked me with is parent education. And that to me is like the explosive hot potato, because, you know, parents tend to look at their children through, you know, rose-tinted glasses and, you know, a little bit, you know, tunnel vision. And who doesn't want to be the parent of the kid that's on the winning team or is successful? But that parent education component is, I think, the key to changing how youth development happens. Mm-hmm. Because A win, a goal, it's that instant gratification. That journey that you just described could be 6, 12, 18 months of that mindset work. How do we stop parents from, and now I'm a parent myself, so how do we stop ourselves from jumping into that instant gratification and trusting, and this I think is really important, trusting the process?
I think that is a societal question. I think we're in a society of instant gratification. So we're inundated with needing results right away. We're very results driven, as America has always been, you know, a very polarizing, like, results driven country. So I do think that plays a really large role. But having been in the education world for a long time and being a teacher and a social emotional coach, it is something that I think is doable, but it takes everybody being on the same side. It takes actual direct instruction to parents. And I think that when you have one club in a city saying one thing and then you can drive 10 minutes to the next club and they're saying the opposite, that doesn't bode well for us as a youth soccer system. And so having a framework for parents, not just a soccer parenting. I love Skyetti. She's amazing. But that's a choice clubs can make to work with her or not. We have to have like a parent education system within the leagues, within U.S. soccer, the federation, all of that. And I think, I don't know that that would happen, but it can't just be a code of conduct. It has to be education around how to be a supportive parent. I'm a parent of three kids. I have a 13-year-old son, a 10-year-old daughter, and a 7-year-old son. All three play comp soccer. So I also look at this from the parent lens. And I think to myself, you know, I'm doing what I think is the right thing. I get in the car, my son loses. He immediately kind of looks angry. I say, I love to watch you play, which is what we're supposed to say, right? And he goes, don't talk, mom. Just stop talking, you know, and he's all angry. And I'm like, oh my God, I said the wrong thing again. And I think every kid is different, which is also why this is really hard. But I do think that, I don't know if you see this, but I find that sometimes our value as parents are completely, we feel the pressure to have the kid that's successful. And we put a lot of our own identity and value as a person on how successful our kids are. And again, that's a societal thing. And I think that that has to have a shift. I know just with my 13-year-old and my 7-year-old, you know, I was much more of a helicopter parent with my 13-year-old. And now that he's older, I see the drawbacks of that. I see the lack of autonomy, the lack of motivation at times with him in certain regards. Whereas with my 7-year-old, I'm changing the way that I'm parenting. I'm not doing everything for him. I'm really letting him sit in that failure and those feelings. But it has to be consistent. If we provide that space at soccer to let kids feel failure and let them sit in it, And then we look at parents and we say, look, this is a game. This is a great safe space for them to practice these feelings. And maybe they're not getting that opportunity at school or at home, but on this field, this is what it's for. Your kid is 7 and they're training 5 days a week. They need to be able to just be a kid and fail and find success and find their passion and be creative and make mistakes. And we just don't allot for that. We're so results driven that we're losing, you know, we're losing what really matters. And it's really sad. It makes me sad to think about, you know, just, and then we get frustrated because they end up on the national team and we're like, why aren't they this way? And we're like, well, it's been years of this. Didn't happen overnight.
No, I couldn't agree more. You know, my son is, you know, he's not a bad player. And I ended up actually coaching him this high school season and finding that sweet spot between go and do, go and have fun, go and express yourself, go and be you, and then also putting him in a box saying, I need you to do X, Y, and Z, was actually quite challenging. I think for me and any parents listening out there, I think where I've been most successful is just setting the table and then walking away and saying, look, here it is. Here's the feast. Go have at it. If you want it, it's there for you.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think we're, as parents and coaches, we're often talking to players and at them rather than like giving them the space to experience, we're not asking them enough questions. Like I would agree. Like when my kid gets in the car, you know, I can ask questions that make him really think. And that's what we do at Female Footballers. It's really just giving them space. Teenagers want to feel seen and they want to feel heard. And when we're talking at them and to them all the time, they're not getting that opportunity, you know? And I think that this is where, for me, a big piece of that coach education too is knowing childhood development. I mean, it's interesting to me that all the licenses in our country to be a coach have all to do with only 3 of the 4 pillars of soccer. And the one, the mental side, which I think most of us would argue is a huge piece of this game. There's no direct instruction around it. There's no education around it. Like, you know, a lot of the coaches they'll put on the youngest ages have no idea what a 7 or 8 year old, their attention span, they have no idea their interests. They're just completely, you know, lost on how to connect with a kid. And I think that's a big piece of our education. And I think parents have lost sight of that too. We forget, it's easy for us to remember the teenage years because that's the closest we are to them. But it's really hard to remember how we felt at 10 before puberty or during puberty. You know, we might remember all the worst aspects, sure, but it is hard to identify and connect with that.
Describe femalefootballers.org. What can people expect to see when they arrive at your destination?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit organization because I truly, this is a passion project turned organization so that we can give back to the sport and we can work with girls in underserved communities as well. But we're providing social, emotional, or psychosocial, or mental skills. There's all the different names for it. And they're really just executive functioning skills, teaching girls how to be self-aware of how they feel, and then give them tools or self-regulation tools on how to navigate that. So we created curriculum that we took basically, a few of us are educators, we took different curriculum and we did a spin, kind of put a soccer spin on it. We have units of curriculum that if you're a team or a club, you can sign up for and do team and club sessions. We do virtual and in person. So for example, the first session would be on self-awareness. They're hands-on activities, paper, pencil activities. We build into motivation, confidence. We have one that's called reset rituals. We do team culture and conflict, how to navigate conflict, body image and comparison issues. So a lot of female specific issues that we feel are aspects that hinder players as they grow through the sport. And then we took those units of curriculum that we do with teams and clubs, and we've also created a mentorship program where we put these in more of an individual space. So we have two times a year, we have a winter and a summer mentorship program. We have a mentor network of about 35 players, all of which played college soccer or higher. We have a few NWSL players. We have pro beach soccer players, pro futsal players, international professional players. And we purposely have a very wide range of mentors because we believe in multiple pathways through the sport. And we put these girls in a little Google classroom where they get our content, and then they're paired with a mentor one-on-one. They get to meet once a week and just talk about the content. They get to talk about their experience with somebody outside of the sport. It's not their coach, it's not their parent, it's not their friend. And they can really just get insight. And it gives, for on the flip side, for female footballers, it gives women like me who have their own kids, who want to still be involved in the sport. Maybe they can't coach. Maybe they do other things. It gives them a way to continue to be active in the sport, to give back. It provides a different type of coach and coaching experience, which I think is really valuable. And I think women need mentors, I think, for us to grow. And, you know, you see the more, most of the women in C-suite, you know, level professions have had a mentor. So I think it really helps provide something different and unique. So it's a lot to wrap your head around, I think, for people, because it's not the norm. It's a unique program, but I do think it's needed and necessary. And we're growing fairly rapidly, which is really exciting. So
how do people get hold of you?
So we have a website, which is www.femalefootballers.org. We're very active on Instagram and LinkedIn. We're FemFootballers on Instagram. We have a podcast as well, that we interview people. Like last week we had Saskia Weber on. So we've got like pro players that come on, a few of our mentors that are in the NWSL, we've had them on, but then we also interview mentees, little, you know, 14-year-old girls, to ask them like, what are you actually going through? Let's hear from you and not just talk about what you're going through. We interview parents, and we've had people like Dan Abrahams and Sky Eddie Bruce, and, you know, people within the sport who want to talk about elements of the mental side that we feel like are important. We have a blog. We have high school girls that join in on that blog. So our website houses all of that. That would be the best place to find us. But there's a lot there, because it's not just about educating the players and the parents, but it's also about educating the soccer world about the value of this side of the sport that doesn't get enough attention, in our opinion.
Cassie Gray, femalefootballers.org. Thank you so much for joining the Bear and the Ball. And for more on Cal South, please visit calsouth.com. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We'll be back next week with more episodes and more soccer talk from the Bear and the Ball. See you then.